Hello, my name is Adrian Goldberg and welcome to the Byline Times podcast. The Byline Times is what the papers don't say, what radio doesn't report and what telly doesn't tell you. This time, how Brexit wrecked the stock market. That is the startling title of a new post by Simon Nixon, one-time chief leader writer for The Times, former chief European commentator on The Wall Street Journal. His The Wealth of Nations is a must-read on Substack for anyone interested in the workings of the UK economy. Simon is no knee-jerk Ramona, if we can permit ourselves that phrase, on the Byline Times podcast. He has been critical in recent times, for example, about the workings of the EU single market. And his analysis of the impact of Brexit on the City of London is both thoughtful and disturbing for anyone concerned about Britain's long-term well-being. It touches on a theme that we explored in a recent podcast with Will Hutton, which, amongst other things, explored the rise of the city during Margaret Thatcher's premiership and the subsequent lopsided nature of the economy. This, in turn, nurtured the sense that many people felt in the Red Wall of being left behind, which was weaponized by those who wanted to leave the European Union. So a really good, meaty conversation ahead. Welcome, Simon. Thank you for joining us. And I was really taken by this article. It was very easy to read, even for an idiot like me, but also, I just thought, hugely important. But there may be some people listening to this thinking, why should I care? Why does the City of London matter to me?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's the stock market in particular that I'm writing about here, and it can't be overstated the role that the stock market has played over the last few decades in the creation of modern Britain. The stock market really was unique. No other country in Europe had anything to compare with it. Thatcher could not have launched her privatisations. Without the success of the privatisations, the city couldn't have gone on to export its shareholder capitalism revolution around the world. It was the stock market's success that turned the city into what it became and made it the financial centre of Europe and the world. So what's happening in the stock market now is a matter of huge consequences, which is that simply it's declining in a really dramatic way. It has underperformed every other stock market of every major economy in the world. Not just this year, where there's been a huge rally in stock markets around the world, everywhere except in Britain, but really almost dating precisely from around the time of the Brexit vote, where in that time, if you put £100 into the stock market in June 2016 after the vote, you would now have an investment of £117. But if you'd put that money into France or Germany or Italy, it would be around £180. And if you put it into America, it'd be £250. So the scale of the underperformance has been huge. British companies are no longer valued as highly as companies in the rest of the world. And that's having a dramatic effect in the stock market, which will have implications for the wider economy, which I think it's so serious that it's astonishing to me that it's not front page news and a source of anguish debates in Parliament and in the media and on political talk shows, because it goes to the heart of what the British economy will be in the future.
Just to check you there for one moment, Simon, I'm sure that many Byline Times podcast listeners will be grinding their teeth when you talk about the success of the city in relation to privatisation. And we've covered on the podcast recently the trials and tribulations of Thames Water and of the water company. So I think there is certainly a perspective that many of my listeners will have, which is that privatisation per se was a bad thing and actually helped to damage the British economy. When I read your blog, you seem to think that it was a good thing, but in any event, it turbocharged the status of the City of London globally.
No, what I meant was, what I said in the piece is that Thatcher was only able to privatise the utilities because Britain had this deep and liquid stock market. In other words, it wasn't just that we had a tradition in this country that was distinct from the rest of Europe, which has more bank-led financial systems. We had this shareholder capitalism system in Britain, which had grown up since Victorian times, really. And it had grown up partly because of the way that companies were raising capital from a large pool of investors, but also because we had these pension funds, which were an important part of our financial system, which were, again, were very different to the way the rest of Europe financed its pensions. It was because we had this system that the Thatcher governments were able to sell the utilities to shareholders. because that was perceived to have been a great success. And because after the Iron Curtain came down, there were countries all over the world that suddenly wanted to modernize their infrastructure, that wanted investment into their utilities, or had corrupt oligarchic elites that wanted to sell the assets they'd seized from the state. That model of privatization in particular became a huge export for the city. And shareholder capitalism was seen not just in Britain, but Britain and America to be the dominant successful model for capitalism. And so the city was able to export its model. So what I'm saying in this piece is that this model of shareholder capitalism is what turns the city and transforms the British economy. It turns Britain into a services superpower, because with the success of the stock market comes all sorts of ancillary jobs, lawyers, accountants, PR advisors, and then all the services that serve the rich, the newly rich, the super rich, hospitality industries, the real estate businesses, architects, schools. That's why I would say that modern Britain was created, in a sense, by the stock market, and why the demise of the stock market, and I think we can put it as strongly as that, has profound implications for Britain's future economic model. It means that a part of the economic model of Britain that people had taken for granted is changing. And that is something we need to confront and think about.
And one of the problematic issues arising from the success of the City of London, notwithstanding that it did bring great wealth to the country and certainly to London and the South East, was that it helped to create, as I mentioned in my introduction, a lopsided economy, one which was very much tilted towards the southern half of the country. And this happened in the time when the Midlands and the north of England and Scotland and Wales were being de-industrialized. And you map out the sense that people felt cut off from the wealth of London, and the sense that people had of being left behind was actually amplified by the success of the City of London.
Yes. And in fact, I've written other posts on my Wealth of Nations Substack that talk directly about some of these issues. I think that the financialization of the British economy is a hugely problematic and contested issue. There's no doubt that, contrary to people's expectations or what people were told, the wealth didn't trickle down, and it didn't trickle down in the way that people had expected. So in that sense, the success of the stock exchange helped to define Britain's economy and define modern Britain in that way too. Not only did it shape the economy, but it also shaped the politics, contributing to this lopsided economy.
That then fed into this sense then of being left behind, which in itself in turn drives the Brexit campaign, which generates support for the decision to leave the EU.
Yes, and I think that's right. I think that in a sense, the stock market becomes a victim in one sense of its own success. But of course, there's another aspect to it too, which was that Brexit was fueled in part by a resentment of the success of the southeast and of the city in particular. And there's a sense that an arrogant global elite were benefiting from globalization. On the other hand, there was another aspect to it, which was Brexiteers who had taken for granted the success of the city. I think they'd come to assume that it was something inherent in Britain, that it was a British exceptionalism, that Britain just had the city because it always had the city. And I think one of the things that had changed over the sort of decades when the city revived in the 80s and 90s as the shareholder capitalism revolution took place, at the start of that process, Britain was exceptional, partly because of the pension funds and partly because it had the stock market. But by the 21st century, those advantages had gone away because capital had become global and free-moving internationally. And the British pension funds, by the way, had all shifted into bonds, so they weren't even in the stock market anymore. So Britain no longer had that advantage. And there were other stock markets competing, both in Europe and, more importantly, in America. So the success of the city had come less to rely on British exceptionalism, but had come to depend actually on its being anchored in this giant single market. And that was something that wasn't understood, I don't think, by the Brexiteers. In fact, it clearly wasn't understood because Boris Johnson in his Brexit deal didn't even try to seek a deal for the city. He just thought it could look after itself. It was this global asset. And the consequences have been disastrous. As I say, the stock market has so badly underperformed the rest of the world as to be a national humiliation. But as a result of that, companies are leaving the stock market. Just in the last week, we've heard that Shell and Glencore, two of the biggest companies in the FTSE 100, are thinking of shifting their listings to New York. Companies that you've expected to list in London are going to Amsterdam and Paris and Germany. And companies that are listed in London that are staying here are just selling all their foreign assets to try and get their share prices up. So London is being deglobalized. The number of stocks listed in London has halved since 1997, 6% down just in last year alone. Investors are voting with their feet. £80 billion worth of investment has been withdrawn from UK equity funds since Brexit, including £5 billion this year alone. The number of listings in 2011, £12 billion worth of equity was raised by companies listing in London. This year, it's just £18 million. London is now the 18th stock market in the world for new issues. The numbers are really dire. And as a result, an entire ecosystem risks collapsing of all those lawyers and bankers and brokers and accountants and PR advisors are sitting there looking at empty profit pools. And that has implications for the tax revenues of the government too. So it's a very serious crisis.
Yeah, bankers, lawyers, accountants may not be the most naturally sympathetic characters in the world, but from the point of view of earning decent wages, from the point of view of then paying taxes, which then feed into the exchequer, which then pay for the schools and the roads and all of the other services that we rely on, are, of course, hugely important. And I want to talk about the specific role of Brexit. Why are companies deserting? Why are they choosing not to list? Is it because as the stock market declines, it is felt that the valuations of their companies will be lower in London than they would be elsewhere, and that therefore they and the firms they represent are worth less?
That's exactly right. Because investors are shunning London. And I think it's fairly clear that they're shunning London because of Brexit and because of the political chaos in Britain. Britain has become an unattractive, risky place to invest your money, per se. Money now is managed globally, and London is about 3 to 4% of the global equity pool. And so investors don't have to invest in Britain. It's an easy one to skip if you just don't like the look of it. So as a result, the UK markets are valued at a discount to the rest of the world. So if you're a company looking to invest, you could sell your shares in London, or you could sell them in Amsterdam and get 20% more, or in New York and get 30% more. So you'd have to think pretty long and hard about why on earth you'd come to London, and that's what's happening.
Why do you think Brexit then is the cause of this? Why, of the many factors that could impact upon a stock exchange, and one of them will be, of course, that having been the leader, other countries have seen what we can do and they've copied us. So there's a natural catching up process that's gone on anyway that would have eaten away at some of London's advantage. So why do you point particularly to Brexit?
Well, the simple answer question, if you just look when the underperformance really starts to kick in, it's in June 2016, and it's never recovered. I've been writing about this throughout those years. And all the way through, people have said, yes, but once Brexit is done, the gap will close. Or once the Tories have got a stable government, that will close. Or foreign bidders will come in and then they'll close the gap. But it's not happening, and it hasn't happened. But I think if you talk to people in the city, if you talk to investors, they're pretty clear that it was Brexit and the political chaos has trashed the reputation of the London market. You could argue about whether this regulation or that regulation makes it a bit more awkward or adds a bit of extra cost, or whether the tax incentives are right for equity investors, all these sort of ideas that are floating around the city. But deep down, basically, when you get down to it, this is primarily a sentiment problem, first and foremost. And it's hard to see how one escapes that. There have been numerous papers published in the city by organizations, institutes, coming up with various different ideas to try and tackle the problem. It's been something that has been alarming people in the city now for several years. Jeremy Hunt came up a couple of years ago with his Edinburgh reforms, which have been a bit of a damp squib. And it's sufficiently serious that Rachel Reeves is saying she's going to have a review of the pension system to try and see if they can get more money into investing in British companies. But the root of it is that global investors are shunning Britain. And that's happened since 2016. And the challenge is, how on earth do you change around that perception?
Just so I understand your analysis then, that the people who felt left behind unintentionally killed the golden goose because they may have resented the relative wealth and influence of London. And so Brexit, as I say, this would have been an unintentional consequence from their point of view. Brexit has helped to drive down the prestige and the value of the stock exchange, which in fact, in the end, impoverishes all of us, whether we live in London and the South East, whether we live in the Midlands, North Scotland or Wales.
I'm afraid I think that's exactly right. That was always the risk. I think, in fact, it was always likely. We had an economic model in this country which, for better or worse, had financial services at the centre. The reasons for that, as I say, were historic, born of Britain's commercial history, with the stock exchange at the forefront of that. And yes, it created an unbalanced economy. And yes, the wealth didn't trickle down. And yes, it was concentrated too much in one part of the country. But it was 8 to 12% of tax revenues for the country. So that is now under pressure. If those tax revenues start to decline or don't grow, then that clearly creates political pressures for the rest of the country too. So yes, I think that's right. I mean, I think people fail to understand at the time of Brexit the extent to which the city's success had come to depend on being part of the single market. I think that the fear always in the city was of a slow puncture. The modern city that had reached its sort of zenith just before the financial crisis, it had been sort of 30 years to get to that point. And so I think what we're seeing now is this slow puncture. We're getting to the point now where one can't help but notice that the tyre's getting a little flat.
Well, you say that, but of course, part of the point you're making as well is that people like you are noticing it, but that politicians, headline writers in the mainstream media are either not noticing it or choosing not to notice it. The Labour Party under Keir Starmer shows no appetite for rejoining the European Union. I'm not sure if you're even advocating that as the solution to this, but what can we do about this? I mean, you would think, wouldn't you, based on what you've said, that if we had a government that was less error-prone, for one thing, that was less chaotic than we've seen with the various Johnson and Truss administrations, that might at least help to restore an air of competence and therefore inspire confidence.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that, that a bit of stability is necessary after the chaos of the last few years. But I don't think it's sufficient. Clearly, the single biggest reform that Britain could do that might reverse this narrative would be to rejoin the EU. But I don't think it's going to happen. I think that even to get to that point would take years and would be hugely politically contested, to create more instability in the process. So I don't see that happening. What I do see, though, is actually the opposite, which is that actually because Boris Johnson's hideous Brexit deal, the way it was structured, there are numerous cliff edges and grace periods that sort of expire over the coming years. The Labour's challenge, it talks about a closer relationship with the EU. But I mean, actually, Labour's challenge will be to stop the trading relationship getting worse. And then, of course, at the same time, it's going to be facing constant pressures because the EU is dynamic. It will change its rules in various different ways. And every single time that happens, the Labour government will have to decide whether to match the EU rules or to create Britain's own rules. And then the relationship will diverge further. That will create more uncertainty around the British economy. It might be politically contested. You can be sure that the right-wing press, especially when there's no longer a Conservative government that has to act responsibly, they're trying to sort of support or prop up. You can be sure the right-wing press will jump on the back of any issue where a Labour government is looking to align with EU rules and champion divergence. So I think it'll be a very, very difficult environment to move Britain closer to the EU. And I think that even with the best will and intentions in the world, the challenge would be not to make the situation worse. I think that is the challenge. Capital goes where it's best treated. And Rachel Reeves has made clear she understands that her challenge is to encourage private capital to invest. But at the same time, the pressures will be enormous to do things. In the short term, will look like panaceas, but in the long term could drive capital away again even more.
Really fascinating to speak to you. Thank you very much indeed for that. The Substack is called The Wealth of Nations by Simon Nixon. And if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, then please consider taking out a subscription to our monthly newspaper, The Byline Times. It's a fantastic read. And you not only get the best of our online offerings there, you also get content in the monthly newspaper that you can't read anywhere else. So do think about taking out a subscription to the Byline Times. You get details over at our website, bylinetimes.com. And in so doing, you will also help to support this podcast too. This has been a We Bring Audio production in Birmingham by me and Harvey White. Our thanks to Simon. We'll see you again very soon. Cheers now. Bye-bye.